Well, good morning. I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Committee on Children and Families Finance and Policy. Sorry to be starting just a minute or two late. Reminder to those watching online that our meeting materials are available on our committee website, so you want to check that out. We have three bills up today, which I'm excited about, but we will first start by having the clerk take the roll as usual. We do have a few folks I know who are running a little bit late, so if they're not here quite yet, I know that they will be joining us very shortly. So, but Ms. Kahn, let's start with that.
Chair Pinto.
Present.
Vice Chair Keeler.
Present.
Lee Daniels.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Coulter.
Present.
Representative Davis.
Here.
Representative Hansen. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Present.
Representative Hicks.
Present.
Representative Hudson.
Present.
Representative Katizik-Watun is excused. Representative Lee.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Perez-Vega is excused.
I know she's running a little bit late as well, but it should be here very shortly.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Present.
A quorum is present.
Good. Next, why don't you call? We have Representative Hansen.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Okay.
And she is here. Right. Excellent. Good stuff. And then we have our meeting minutes from our meeting on, I guess it would have been Thursday, January 26th. And maybe I'll ask the Vice Chair if she's willing to move approval of the minutes of the January 26th meeting.
Looking at the minutes, yes, Chair, I move the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. I should note you're making sure that Representative Katizik-Watun, we had some challenge with her spelling, but we've got that correct on this one. So excellent. So any additions or corrections to the January 26th minutes? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of the January 26th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. We've successfully passed that motion, and we have our minutes approved. So again, members, three bills up today. The plan is for the first of these bills will be voted out to the Health Committee. That'll be the motion there. And the remaining two bills are within the jurisdiction of our committee. And so the plan is to simply lay them over for possible inclusion in a budget bill later in the session. And so with that, since Representative Bonner, she was on a previous committee of mine, but is not on this committee. And so Vice Chair Keeler, if you'd be willing to move House File 639, be referred to the Committee on Health, Finance and Policy, that would be great.
So move, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler. And so, Representative Bonner, welcome, and please begin with your presentation, and we'll carry on. By the way, I should note, I will have to run to another committee for a bill in a little bit, but then we'll be coming back, and Vice Chair Keeler, of course, will take over. So, Representative Bonner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do have an amendment, the A1-1, to get it in the shape I would like it. If we could start with that, I would be delighted.
It looks like a fairly technical amendment, and so Vice Chair Keeler, if you're willing to move approval of that A1-1 amendment for Representative Bonner.
I move the amendment, Chair.
Thank you. So, members, this is fairly technical, just a few lines. Any questions at all for the author? And so, seeing none, all in favor of the approval of the A1-1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wishes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. So, Representative Bonner, we've got House File 639 as amended, and so please carry on with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 639 provides funding for the Community Solutions for Healthy Child Development Grant Program through the Minnesota Department of Health. The focus of the program is to improve measures of well-being for Minnesota's children of color and American Indian children from prenatal to age 8. Through a community and equity-centered approach. Minnesotans are proud to be leaders in the nation for overall child well-being, but if we look at outcomes for children of color, we rate in the bottom third. Children of color are among the poorest Minnesotans, with vast racial disparities for Black, American Indian, Latino, and Asian American children. This is simply unacceptable. The Community Solutions Grant Program is a strategy in which we can begin to address these disparities upstream. It leverages our community assets to address these problems and bring those most impacted into the decision-making process. In 2019, the legislature created a pilot program whose goals were threefold. First, to improve child development outcomes. This includes early learning, health and well-being, economic security, and safe, stable, nurturing relationships and environments. Second, reduce racial disparities in children's overall health and development. And third, promote racial and geographic equity. The mission of the program is to fund community-based solutions to address challenges clearly identified by the impacted communities, which, while delivering strategies that provide efficient and culturally relevant services to communities of color and our indigenous communities. Eligible grantees include organizations, nonprofits, tribal nations that are all either led by or work directly with these communities. We must recognize that to achieve equity, we must build authentic community partnerships and fund trusted organizations led by groups, the groups that they serve. The state has appointed the Community Solutions Advocacy Council, or the CSAC, to advise MDH on the development and implementation of the RFP process and the selection of the grantees. The council will continue to advise MDH and the management of the program moving forward. The CSAC is comprised of diverse community representatives with a high level of expertise in the areas of child development and community intervention services. Finally, we are requesting funding to make community solutions available to every community in Minnesota. The pilot has shown great promise, and now is the time to scale this concept to provide life-changing opportunities to every Minnesota child. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, you will find in your folders, you have information about the programs, the list of organizations that have received these grants from the program. And I thank you for your support. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. And I'll note that I know there was at least one additional message that was sent just this morning to committee members, I think from the Prenatal 3 Policy Coalition in support as well. So I'm not sure if Diane Halsey is going first. Please, yeah, identify yourself. So glad to have you here, and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. I am Diane Halsey, and I am President and CEO of the Family Partnership, but I also have the pleasure and honor of being the co-chair for the Voices and Choices for Children Coalition. Voices and Choices for Children is a coalition that has focused on improving the outcomes for children of color and American Indian children ages 0 to 8. We are focused on the implementation of policies and practices that meaningfully highlight the opportunities that exist in the state of Minnesota. And our steering committee is entirely composed of people of color and American Indians. We support House File 639 because we know it to be a strategy that amplifies the innovative solutions that leverage community assets that are culturally relevant and center the experiences and dignity of those most impacted by inequity. We stand with the governor and the legislature in our efforts, in all of our efforts, to make Minnesota the best place to live for all families. Unfortunately, however, we recognize that for many families of color and American Indians, currently, Minnesota is not a healthy place to live. And we are committed to changing that. Community Solutions Grant Program represents more than just an allocation of money. It is also a recognition that communities of color, American Indian communities, and geographically dispersed communities have invaluable knowledge and must be active and valued participants with the creation of solutions for themselves. We piloted the program beginning in late 2019, and even though many of the grantees had to implement in the middle of a global pandemic, we are still seeing great results. We believe that it is because communities have the flexibility to design solutions to the issues in their own backyards. We know that sustained funding is key to making sure that we continue to build positive outcomes over time. So it is imperative that communities are able to access the funding beyond the pilot. So we strongly encourage you to support House File 639. The collective health and prosperity of our state is ultimately tied to ensuring that every child has what they need to thrive. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to one of our grantees to talk about how they have their experience in receiving Community Solutions grant funding.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself, pronouns if you prefer. members of the committee.
Yeah. Good morning, Chair Pinto and all members of the community. My name is Diana Alvarez. I'm the Early Childhood Programs Director at Centro Tyrone Guzman. Centro Tyrone Guzman is the oldest Latino organization in Minneapolis. We serve Latino families from 0 to 100 plus. One of our programs is Siembra Montessori that provides preschool services, education to children to 3 to 6. And when we asked parents 5 years ago why their dreams about how Siembra could expand, they talked about having home visiting programs because they wanted to learn what they have learned at Siembra before. So when we learned about the Community Solution Grant, we saw this opportunity to make this program culturally relevant. That's the importance of the Community for Solution Grant, because they provide all the elements, so they create their own curriculum for the home visiting program. They create the solution for the needs that they were seeing in our community. And we started our program in 2020 in the middle of the pandemic. We gather information from the community, we create our curriculum, and now we have served, last semester, we served 32 families with the home visiting program. They learn about child development, they set their own goals, they create their own solutions. We are always asking about what we could do better, what the needs are, what they want to learn. And when their children are 3 years old, they go to Siembra. So it's a connection between birth and preschool. And they're thriving for the program. And we want to continue with this program so our children in our community could thrive and be part of this amazing community that Minnesota is. And lastly, I want to thank Alejandra Saldivar, that she's one of our moms that came here to support the funding for the Community Solution Program. Thank you.
Thank you. That's all we have for testifiers. We'll open it up if there's any public testify. Seeing none, we'll move on to discussion of the bill. Do we have? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the language of the bill, there's a couple of references here to an accountability process. There's a reference to independent third-party entity that is to evaluate the success of the grant program to build the evidence base for effective community solutions in reducing health disparities of children of color, so forth and so on. This is, as I understand it, making permanent something that has been in a pilot phase. Are there existing evidences and models of how this type of accountability has functioned?
Representative Bonner, do you?
Thank you, Vice Chair. I might phone a friend. Do we have someone from MDH who can speak greater to the way that the grant is administered? Or the Department of Health? Oh. You may also have one of my testifiers who can also speak to that.
Good morning. Yes, you.
Come on up.
Sorry.
That's okay. Please introduce yourself and let us know who you're with for the committee.
I'm Dr. Halkan Utra. I'm the director for Center for Health Equity at MDH. I also lead the team that is managing this program. In terms of some of the language that the representative members of the committee are mentioning, this is, I just want to go back a little bit and say a little bit about this program so that we get some context. The program is effective in a way we're super monitoring it and then evaluating it, mainly because it starts with its design. The program is designed in a way that it is actually engage community in a meaningful way, the way that people that were testifying, sharing with us today, right? So it really engages community in a meaningful way. It brings communities, not only help community to identify the problem, but also to design a solution for the problem that they see in their community. That made it the program really the most effective one because they own it. I just wanted to put that out there. Second is really it targets community that are most impacted. 30% of children in Minnesota live in the community that are most impacted, that are mentioned in this testimony today. So that gives us the closer proximity to work with this community to address their problem by engaging them. So that is why the program is impactful. Thirdly, MDH does consistent, regular capacity building to the community that are funded, community organizations that are funded through this program. That actually not only improve the impact of the program, it also leaves that capacity building for the community to meaningfully engage with us, with their government, to implement the program. So there are evaluation that is going on, there are evaluation that is done, so we can share the impacts of the program. We do have stories from the community in terms of what impact this program is making. So there is an evaluation MDH conducted to see the impact of this program. So we really see this program as a most effective program and then one of the best program because it engages community in an authentic way and a meaningful way to address their own problem.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I'm looking for is more of a concrete example of how we're determining that these programs are successful. I mean, you talk about them owning it. These are taxpayer dollars that we're granting to organizations, and according to the language here in line 210 and 211, the advisory council is focusing on outcomes that grantees agree to achieve. What's the process by which those outcomes are determined, and then how do we know that they've been achieved or not?
Yeah, in terms of the concrete deliverables and the impact of the program, I will pass to one of my colleagues, Sarah Schultz, who is an assistant director, and then also we do have a program manager that is managing that program directly, so they can give you some of the concrete kind of detail of the program. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself with your agency for the committee.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Schutt, and I am the assistant director of the Center for Health Equity. Thank you all. In terms of our third-party evaluator, at this time, we have a third-party evaluator who is monitoring and working with all of the grantees across the program, including American Indian grantees. We have a specific American Indian evaluator as well. And to date, we have seen that the grantees have served over 5,000 parents, families, children, caregivers, doulas, teachers, elders, and community members. They do this, as Dr. Torres said, through a variety of community-based interventions, some of which are evidence-based, some of which are practice-based evidence, and so that is developing in real time, and that's what makes this program so unique and meaningful to communities that we're impacting.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. Any follow-up?
I'll just state that I can't claim to understand what any of that means in terms of practical deliverables of what
we
are receiving.
Oh, excuse me.
And whatever the response is, I'm done after that. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Yeah. Excuse me, I was going to say we could certainly get back to you with, you know, specific outcomes of each grantee based on their work plans and their deliverables. We're in the process of evaluating our year one reports and coming up with that aggregated data to show you the themes, and we'd be happy to share that with you.
I think we would be happy to receive that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Just to be clear, I think one of the parts of the question that you're asking is about metrics and outcomes. And specifically, one of the items that in particular we can provide is data, for example, on children entering into kindergarten and their readiness for that program. So I think that is maybe one of the concrete type of metrics that you're specifically looking for. And that's a fairly common metric for a home visiting program. I have long been a fan of home visiting. The beauty of this particular grant is that it also accepts and acknowledges that there are programs that need to be culturally responsive to certain communities and be able to meet people where they are. We have seen really incredible results from home visiting programs over the years. They've been highly, highly successful in getting kids ready for school, providing better family outcomes, better health and well-being for young children. They are really tremendous, and they have great capacity to potentially close things like educational gaps before they even have a chance to get a foot in the door. And so that's why these programs are really so vitally important, and I've had the pleasure of seeing them in practice and seeing the faces of the kiddos as they're learning, seeing the pride in mom's face as a dual language family is learning, and being able to know that she's providing a better level of education and a brighter start for her children than she could have ever hoped for. And I think that's where the real beauty of these programs begins. And getting those kiddos off to a good start, as we know, if they start behind, it's often difficult to catch up. This program gives them the great start that they need to be ahead of the game right out of the gate when they get into kindergarten and to take off and to flourish.
Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Bonner, for being here today. I'm a co-author of this bill. I'm hugely supportive of this program. And I want to thank you for the work that we have done together on the former Early Childhood Committee over the years. I know that home visiting and this type of solution has been a passion of yours for a long, long time. And I think that it's important to just to note, you know, because traditional home visiting programs, we've done what we can. We're continuing to try to reach families who have not yet been able to participate. But I think that there are a number of families who aren't necessarily comfortable with a traditional home visiting program. And I think that one of the part of the power of this program is that it's already established in the community. And these programs, these organizations already have trust with their neighborhoods, with the families in their neighborhoods, and I think that really goes a long way in helping folks feel comfortable asking for the help that either they know that they need or they might not know yet that they need, and to see the kids blooming and to see the parents coming into their own through these programs is so wonderful. So thank you so much.
Representative Brezbega.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative. I just want to point out how important this is and how I look forward to supporting this and highlight as well Diana Alvarez's work and the work out of Centro Tyrone Guzman, and highlight what you stated in the importance of cultural competency, how cultural relevancy is impactful. I've seen it grow, not just within this organization and the years of work that it's been a foundation and a staple for the Minneapolis community, but how it's been an outline of a platform for other organizations throughout the state to work with our diverse community and diverse parents and children. So I just want to highlight how impactful this is. It's beautiful work. Thank you for carrying this, Representative, and I look forward to supporting it.
Gracias. Thank you. Any other discussion? Lee Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a whole lot more comments than my colleague, Mr. Hudson, had. I just think there's a lack of accountability in this, and after the misfortunes and disaster that the Feeding My Future was, and sometimes we need to be very cautious of what tax dollar money funds and make sure it's done appropriately and has guardrails on it and checks and balances on it. It'll be interesting to see. We have a OLA report coming on February 2nd, and I would really like us to back off some of these spending bills until we find out if the money we've already appropriated is actually doing what it's supposed to do. That's my feeling. I just think as the guardian of our hard-earned tax dollars of our constituents, we need to make sure that every dollar is spent for what it's intended for. So that's the only comment I have. This may be a great program. It may be. I'm a little surprised at the cost. It went from $39 million for the two-year biennium to $50 million. So I don't know what the reasoning was behind that, but we'll just have to kind of wait and see. So I appreciate the intent of the bill. I just hope that we can make sure that's working the way it's supposed to.
Thank you, Lee Daniels. Representative Bonner, final comments?
Yes, thank you. I just want to be clear that in terms of making sure that these programs are being delivered, these are programs in which there is direct community engagement. There is no doubt that the program is being delivered. And it is being delivered with evidence-based and practice-based methodologies that have been tried and true and have been practiced for years. So we know they work, in other words. And one. They have the report available. We will be delighted to provide to you some of the outcomes from the pilot as well. You know, I think that, you know, as most members here have not had the opportunity, I have to tell you the ability to see a home visiting program and a home visiting visit in person is an experience I will not likely forget. To see those little faces, to see the parents and the great pride that they have. The visit I took was a young woman who was a first immigration immigrant. Her primary language was Spanish. And to see her face as her children were successful, to see them growing, to see them flourishing, to hear her talk about that was really incredible. And I think these are really incredible opportunities. As for the cost, I think, you know, we tried this as a pilot program initially because we wanted to prove the concept. We wanted to make sure that it was solid, that the connections were in place, that the monitoring and the metrics were in place, that all of those pieces were there and they were ready. They're ready. And so really we have a great opportunity to extend these particular programs to children all over the state of Minnesota in a way that's really meaningful and begin to get grasp a hold on some of the gaps in education that we have seen across the state. Minnesotans want to be leaders in the nation. We believe that we are, but we haven't always filled all of the gaps. And this is a way for us to directly meet the need exactly where it is within the communities and within providers that actually understand their community, that have a foothold, a trust with their community, that can really make a difference. So I really appreciate your time today to review this bill, and I would be grateful if we could get it on to the Health Committee for its next stop. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Bonner and testifiers. We will now renew the motion to have House File 639 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Ayes have it. That will be moving on. Representative Bonner, thank you. We'll be moving on to our next bill. We can get ready for House File 910. Representative Breyer. Good morning, Representative Breyer. Thank you for joining us. We'll move to Representative Perez Vega. Will you move House File 910 to be laid over?
I move House File, 910 to be laid over.
Yep, you're good. Thank you. We'll start with you, Liz Breyer, if you want to give us, Representative Breyer, do you want to give us an overview of the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for committee members. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Today we're here to talk about creating a dedicated source of funding for specialized services for families with children who live in supportive housing. House File 910 fills a critical gap in funding for family supportive services. The Homeless Youth Act, which is included in the Pathway Homelessness Prevention Program, provides essential funding for specialized services for families living in supportive housing until the parent or guardian is 25 years old. Unfortunately, nothing similar exists for families after the head of household turns 25. This includes the majority of families living in supportive housing. The benefits of supportive housing are profound. Homelessness is day-to-day trauma. Many families are fleeing violence in their homes, and often children are separated from their families while the family is homeless. For children, the scars can be lifelong, and this burden falls most heavily on Minnesota's Black and Brown communities. Supportive housing provides these families safe, non-time-limited housing with on-site services to help them recover from the trauma of homelessness and move forward. Numerous studies have shown that it is the most effective means of preventing homelessness across generations. House File 910 gives us the opportunity to invest in our most vulnerable families when the parent or guardian has aged out of youth-oriented programs. It provides $10 million per biennium to provide customized, trauma-informed, and culturally specific mental health, socialization, and educational programming for children, in addition to education, career planning, parenting skills, and counseling for their parents or guardians. I will now turn it over to my testifiers to explain more specifically how this will work, and will then look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. We'll move to Reverend Nancy Nordfens.
Good morning.
Please introduce yourself. Let us know the organization you're with.
I'm Reverend Nancy Nordfens. I hope you can hear me. Public Policy Manager at Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative. Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler and members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify in support of House File 910, the Family Supportive Housing Act. Beacon is a nonprofit collaborative of 90-plus congregations working together to create deeply affordable housing and provide high-quality services for our residents. We have nearly 700 homes in greater metro area with plans underway to create another 170. Our priority is on creating 30% AMI supportive housing for families. Nearly 3,400 Minnesota families with children experience homelessness on any given night. As this committee knows, homelessness itself is intensely traumatizing and often results from other forms of trauma, such as domestic violence. This can begin a cycle of homelessness passed on through generations. Research shows that family supportive housing is the most dignified and effective way to break that cycle. It's also the most cost-effective in the long run, creating positive economic value for participants, private funders, taxpayers, and society as a whole. But in the short term, providing quality specialized family services is a costly investment, averaging $15,000 per household per year in Beacon developments. Currently, no state funding for these services is available for families with children once the parent or guardian is age 25 or older. This critical gap in funding not only impacts families already living in supportive housing, the prohibitive cost of these services is a primary reason that very little family supportive housing is being built in Minnesota, despite the great need. I want to draw your attention here to the letter of support provided by Carrie Cadwell, a mental health practitioner in Aitken and Little Falls, who was unable to attend today's hearing. She speaks to the pressing need for additional family supportive housing in greater Minnesota, where even fewer resources are available for families at risk of homelessness. This is not just a problem endemic to the metro area. So how will HF 910 help? First, the bill defines family broadly as a non-temporary household that includes at least one child and one adult or parent or legal guardian. This means its benefits will be available to grandparents who are raising their grandchildren, as well as adult siblings raising younger siblings and non-biological guardians. Second, it defines family supportive housing and the types of specialized family support services that can be funded under the program. Finally, it appropriates $5 million in 2024 and $5 million in 2025 to DHS to fund these services statewide and provide technical assistance. This will provide specialized services to between 225 and 450 families every year. I'd like to close by thanking committee members for the commitment you've shown to homelessness prevention for children and families by supporting the Pathway Home Act. I urge you to consider supporting House File 910 as well. Passing the Family Supportive Housing Act will transform the lives of Minnesota children and parents currently living in supportive housing and enable more supportive housing to be constructed to help additional homeless families. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move on to our next testifier, Sarah Koshinska.
Yeah, good job.
Introduce yourself and who you're with for the
meeting. Good morning. Hi, Vice Chair Keeler and committee members. I'm Sarah Koshinska, she, her, and I'm the Senior Director of Resident Services at Project for Pride and Living. For over 50 years, PPL has worked to build the hope, assets, and self-reliance of families who have lower incomes by providing transformative, affordable housing and career readiness services. At PPL, we firmly believe that housing isn't a roof. It's the floor. It's the foundation where families build better lives. We know if families are in stable housing, they get healthier, they get better jobs, their children do better in school, and everything flourishes. PPL owns, manages, or provides services to over 1,600 units of affordable housing here in the metro area, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and out in the western suburbs. Close to 3,500 people live with us every night, and about half of our units are supportive housing, so dedicated to households making less than that 30% of the area median income and coming out of homelessness in our shelter systems. We're very grateful that you're considering funding a new stream dedicated to family supportive housing services. We know it's critical to providing that two-generational wraparound support that families need to break that cycle of poverty and have housing stability. At PPL, we have five family supportive housing programs in which 94% of our households are headed by adults ages 25 or older. We partner with these families to set their own kind of person-centered, family-centered goals around tenant education, eviction prevention, benefits navigation, increasing their income, and a range of physical, mental, and chemical health supports. And then equally important in family supportive housing is our youth and parenting services set, which is early childhood screening, school navigation, child welfare system support, youth mental health, mentorship, and so much more. At one of our sites, Fort Road Flats in Representative Pinto's district, I have a longtime staff member who this fall, some of our teens, kind of they and their parents came to our staff member struggling with things at school, attendance, some of them, doing some early chemical use stuff. And because of that on-site regular presence, that long-term relationship, that staff member was able to help those parents and those teens in this trusting space navigate some of those, as well as get some of them into summer employment through the city's Right Track program. Current funding for family supportive housing is just not adequate. At PPL, it ranges between $13,000 and $17,000 per family per year to kind of support these services. We braid funding together from the public and private sector and always have a deficit. And we can talk later, you may be familiar with some other state programs that support services, and none of those are close to adequate to giving us kind of what we need. It also is really difficult to build new housing, as Nancy mentioned, when we don't know that there will be service funding available. So by passing House File 910 and creating a dedicated source of funding, we'll be able to ensure that our lowest income families can be supported. I'd like to thank Representative Ryer and the committee for this opportunity today, and we're available for questions.
Thank you. That's all I have on the list for testifiers. We'll open it up for anybody here who's testifying from the public. Seeing Seeing none, we will move on to discussion. Hemmingson Yeager.
Thanks. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for presenting this bill. In my day job outside of session, I remember hearing about Project of Pride and Living, but what, not in a housing sense, but in an employment sense. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, kind of, that speaks to kind of the wraparound services you describe. Could you describe how you're helping people kind of with their employment so they can get better on their feet?
Yeah, you are correct. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm new to this.
That's okay. So am I. So we're in this together.
I'm learning.
Go ahead. Koshinska, Ms. Koshinska. Did I do it right again?
Yeah. So, yes, at PPL, we do kind of housing stability work, and then we also do career readiness services, and we do integration between the two. So we have career specialists our housing specialists in our housing work closely and can make referrals and connect with our career readiness specialists. And our career kind of pathways programs are everything from, you know, getting ready and just job searching or getting a better job, to we have pathways programs where we're partnering with the banking sector or healthcare, and people are getting training, internships, a lot of times some secondary education credits along with that. And so that's kind of our range of services. We also bundled into our career pathways, do a lot with financial coaching and helping people look at other ways that they're going to manage their income and their assets. And eventually, for a lot of folks, you know, maybe home ownership is that dream kind of on that path.
Representative Hemmingson Yeager, do you have more?
Yeah, thank you. I just kind of want to say this from experience. It is it's a competitive program. With some sectors, and it has seen a lot of success. So I just think that's a really cool kind of wraparound, getting people ready. And thanks.
Thank you. Other discussion? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had some questions regarding the definitions offered and trying to understand how people qualify for these services. So there's a between lines 110 and 118 is a fairly elaborate definition of family permanent supportive housing, and the residents who qualify to receive these services are defined by that definition, as I understand it. Can you give me a practical real-world example of where such housing is located, what it looks like, how people are finding it? I just want to understand the program more.
Ms. Benz?
I'll start, and then I'll probably hand it over to Sarah. These programs right now are found both in their own larger developments, but more likely they're smaller groups in larger developments, simply because the services cost so much. So at Beacon, it is our goal in the next 3 years or so to build 3 full developments of family supportive housing. But there's no possible way at this time that we could manage then the ongoing support services costs. Each of those developments, their services every year would cost about $600,000. So we would be able to help another 120 families that are experiencing homeless and most high risk for being homeless if we had the money to say that we could provide those services. Does that make sense? They're spread out all over the state. So, for instance, Common Bond has several townhomes in the Aitken and Little Fall areas where they provide these services to families in supportive housing. You can find large developments in some areas, but there's a lot of scattered site or smaller sites. And now I'm going to hand it over to the woman who provides these services. Did I say that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So I think it can look all ways. So at PPL, I have a building where all the units, all 44 on the east side of St. Paul, are family supportive housing. And then the Fort Road Flats building off of West 7th and Representative Pinto's district, the 44-unit affordable housing building, 16 of those units are dedicated to families coming out of homelessness. So our supportive housing, the rest is affordable housing for people at 50% of AMI or below. In PPL's family supportive housing, because of how the structure with capital funding for building housing is they have to come out of long-term homelessness. And so the individuals coming into our programs are coming through that coordinated entry system. So they're homeless, and they're usually going through the shelter system or being assessed and getting on those coordinated entry kind of systems that are run by county or by groups of counties. And then when I have an opening, I go to, and we get like person highest priority on that list with their homelessness, they get referred, and then we bring them in. Does that give you the picture you're looking at? Does that help?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It definitely helps. I'm interested in kind of the development side of it as well. So you say you need to build more of this housing that qualifies as this in order to be able to provide the services. Yeah. How does that work? Who are the developers? How does the interaction with local government work, the approval process? Is it, do you aim to have this housing that qualifies
yes.
as this? Okay.
So Beacon's goal, I'm sorry, Nancy Nordbenz. Beacon's goal is to only build 30% AMI supportive housing. Right now, that is difficult to fulfill that goal because of the costs of providing the services. And it's when there's limited capital funding out there, it's understandable that the financiers would want to make sure that we have secured all the funding that we need for the services before they approve and provide the funding for the construction. So it's a chicken and an egg situation where because we don't have enough funds for the services, we can't then build the developments that have been shown to be so successful at breaking the cycle. In answer to your last question about where our residents come from, we also use that method, but we also get families that are referred directly from Child Protective Services. These are families that have been separated because of homelessness, and now they're coming back together in family reunification, which, as you know, is an extremely vulnerable time in the life of a family, and that's when they really need to have on-site services available to help.
Representative Hudson, follow-up.
Thank you for your answers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. I have a comment and a question, and I think I maybe know the answer to the question, but I'm just going to ask to make sure. I know that these services are so, so vital. I'm happy to be a co-author on this bill because I know how important supporting families when they are coming out of a child protection case is. But one of the things that I have seen be really valuable, and confirm for me if I'm wrong, but when children are coming and families are coming and getting these services, and there's maybe a developmental concern, potentially a child with a disability. Can you share with the committee kind of how your supportive staff make sure that that child gets connected to the other things that are really going to get them across that finish line?
Whoever's going to take that.
Again, Sarah Koshinska with PPL. Absolutely, right? So our staff are like navigators. They help people navigate these, our families navigate complex systems that can be really overwhelming and confusing by having relationships. One of the things, there's a talk about a best practice in early childhood is called the ages and stages kind of assessment tool that you do with children birth to 5 years old that kind of looks at developmental milestones they should be meeting every 6 months. So one of the things our children and youth coordinators are they're trained to do those with parents to identify things early and then make the referrals and either bring services in the home or help families get to them. So it's about navigating systems. Then it's also about maybe supporting with transportation issues and all those other things that might be barriers so often to families who are lower income, have had trauma, right, accessing all the things in our community.
Representative Hicks, follow up.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say how incredibly valuable that is. Navigating our disability services, especially our early childhood, early intervention services, when you have multiple players, right? We've got human services, we've got education, we've maybe got health, we've maybe got PT and OT, and you know some of those other components is so challenging. And if you already have some other barriers that you're working through, right? You've just been reunified, you're dealing with some low income, the thing that's going to fall off is all of those extra balls in the air. And so the support that you're providing really ensures that children with disabilities, particularly children with disabilities who are in these families that are needing these additional supports, don't get left behind simply because of those extra needs. So I just want to say thank you again for including them in the conversation and bringing that to our attention today.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Ryer and Reverend Bentz and Ms. Kushinska for joining us. This is such an important bill because of the recent increase in the need to house our homeless families. And so I just want to thank you for your work. I represent the East Side. I know a lot of our residents are beneficiaries of this program. That's just my comment, and I want to know if you want to comment on the increase in imminent need that you've seen recently.
And Ms. Kushinka, yeah, we should keep it relatively, and we've got another two more members after this. So Ms. Kushinka, I think you're being asked to comment.
Super brief, right? We're all seeing the growing need on the East Side. We too at PPL are trying to develop a new project, actually, because we've seen a growing need in kind of multi-generational, intergenerational families, grandparents parenting their children. And so again, we're going for capital funding, but needing to secure the support services to bring that to life on the East Side.
Thank you. Good. Representative Lee, looks like, okay, we're going to move on to Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you for being here today. I just had a couple questions that I thought maybe you could help, because I'm looking at some of the initiatives in the family supporting housing, and on 2.5 and 2.6 is talking about educational assessment and referrals and then career planning and work skill. And that's something I'm really curious about, because we have this workforce shortage, specifically in 24-hour settings like nursing homes, assisted livings. So I'm curious as to if there's health occupations pathways for the people you serve, and what metrics do the navigators have for this committee to share some of the success stories of, 100% dependency on government programs and then fully vesting out to, maybe 20%, or, to have pathways for that with what we're doing, and then introducing the trades and introducing health occupations to fill some of these gaps in our community, because we have jobs there. So I wondered if you could speak to that.
Ms. Kushinka or Reverend Bentz. Yeah,
I'll start with that, and just to point out that we often think of 30% AMA housing as for people who are not working, but actually 34% of 30 AMI families in Minnesota are in the mm-hmm. workforce. Mm-hmm. And so this is actually a workforce housing program. And then I'm going to defer to Sarah to talk about the kind of programs and answer some of your questions.
And if I could just, an AMI, area median income.
Thank you.
And so, a measure of yeah. poverty.
Okay. And, do you want me to say one more thing, or have you got one?
No, I mean,
Ms. Kushinka, yeah, and as I say,
I want to be
pretty
right
here, yeah.
So there, right, I think you're super important that we're working on this integration between kind of housing providers and folks doing that navigation work with kind of our whole kind of career training, employment training continuum. At PPL and at some of the other employment training providers, Hire, Twin Cities Rise, there are things in healthcare and in some of those, right, those high growth industries and the industries that need jobs and are also paying wages and have wages that have an upside, or places that people can move up in the market in those companies. So like our strategic plan, right, we really work on integration and how we're making referrals and getting families who are interested connected. One of the metrics we track is when families, what's their income when they come in with us, and how does that grow each year? And is that growing just in their benefits, or is it an earned income? So those are some of the metrics, again, we're looking at and we're measuring annually to kind of see how some of this happens. Does that get quickly to some
of
your
we'll
questions?
Give it to Representative Zalesnikar, see if that helps.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to see some of those metrics
okay.
that you're using and some of the success, what the baseline has been.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, a thought is, so this bill is being laid over. Vice Chair Keeler may have mentioned, but there have been some confusion about jurisdiction, but we've confirmed this will be in our committee as it's being laid over. And so, appreciate if you all could provide some of
sure.
that follow-up, Representative Zalesnikar is requesting. So so we're going to go to Vice Chair Keeler. I know I had something, and then we'll go to the bill's author and then wrap up. Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. I think it's no secret here that I am passionate about ending homelessness in Minnesota and understanding that there's many components to that. And so I deeply appreciate you and the work that you all do in this community for future generations. One of the things that I want to point out that I like about this is the expansion of family. Coming from a culture that, we're ripped apart, not by choice, and other people step in. I'm an auntie who has been an auntie/mom, my whole entire life. And so I do appreciate the expansion of that and understanding that family for some of us, not by choice, looks a bit different. Mm-hmm. I also love that you talk about braiding funding. I think it's important to understand that this is something that the community is also investing in, not only financially, but you know, the boots on the ground, the implementation of what we need to do to grow to make our community successful, including the financial piece of it. You know, a lot of it is that maybe we just don't know what we don't know, and providing those opportunities for us to learn and grow. Because the truth is, like some of us, like myself, who've experienced homelessness, really want to be better. We just don't have the tools. So I appreciate all of the work you're doing collectively around this. And I just appreciate Representative Ryer particularly for this work. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. And so to the author, Representative Ryer, please, final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the committee. I appreciate all of the questions because to me it reflects the priorities that I also share related to effective programming, wide-ranging programming that touches on all the needs, and as well as the requirement to demonstrate their effectiveness. So with that, I will thank you for your time and hope to see this move forward as committee work progresses and the session goes along.
Thank you so much, Representative Ryan. Thanks to both of you testifiers. I had a chance to work with Nancy Nordvents a fair amount. Not had a chance to work with Sarah Kashinka, but I could already tell that folks are the community is really, really lucky to have you. And so with that, the chair lays over. We do not need to. I'm sorry. Oh, Lee Daniels, were you going to say something? I'm so sorry. I did not.
Yeah, thank you.
You were
chair.
Going to. I'm so sorry. Okay, yeah.
I didn't raise my hand, but it has been customary for, well, since you and I have been here for sure.
Oh, yeah. Okay, no,
Lee
well, please, Lee Daniels.
The bill author, so I apologize for going in.
Oh, please. Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
Representative Rare. I just have a couple little questions on the bill on line 2.19, and I noticed on other bills it was similar language, support and increase capacity to new and existing services, and that language has been in a couple places. So I don't know if there's parameters for these new providers, if they have to go through any background checks or anything like that. So that's one. I'm just curious on why it's worded that way. Another one was I was curious on where the funding will go to. I knew there's certain entities that receive this funding, and when you put new in the language, we don't know what those entities are. So somebody can maybe explain to me, either the bill author or maybe one of the testifiers, of you know, kind of what that picture looks like. And I've got one follow-up after that.
Okay, no problem. So we have, it looks like Reverend Nordvents, please.
Thank you for the question. So in 2.19, that is referring to pretty much the same process that we use, that the state uses to identify service providers for instance, the Homeless Youth Act. And often it might be the same service providers, but now they are being paid because the adult in the family has reached 25 years or older, and the Family Homeless Youth Act falls off. So it's the exact same process. And in fact, at DHS, they told me they'll just make another little box. And when people fill out their grant requests, if the parent is 25 or older, they click that box. As to the question of, what was the other question? Developers. And I'm sorry, I've lost.
Well, Lee Daniels, please, if you restate that question.
What entities will actually receive in the funding? That's what my confusion is, because we have new in the language, and you've kind of explained that a little bit.
So it would largely be nonprofit.
Please.
I'm so sorry.
No, that's no problem.
It would largely be nonprofit developers like Beacon or. And PPL is a developer, but they're also a service provider. So when we build these developments, we usually partner with a group like PPL, and both entities provide the funding for the services. And so it would help out on both the developer side and on the service provider side.
Lee Daniels.
One last follow-up. I'm a little confused on where all the funding comes, and I'm just going to ask that. I know we've got like $5 million and $5 million in this bill, but our local community in Faribault has many different options for similar things, and it's not using any tax dollars. It's all volunteer work, or it's we have the Ruth's House in Faribault for battered women's shelter, and it's they do a one gala a year for fundraising. They do donations, so it's no. In fact, I tried to get a little money into that Ruth's House. They do great work. They've got like 9 or 10 houses that they own for the transitional part. So I'm just wondering, is there any options, any donations, any private companies to actually helping out? Because I would love to see that partnership.
I'm Reverend Nordbentz.
Beacon has a very vigorous fundraising program, and we do fundraise a lot for these kind of services, as I know they do at PPL. But when you're talking about $15,000 per family per year, that adds up very, very quickly. And, of course, these service providers often, they have to be credited in the various areas that they're providing services for. So it's often a little bit more in-depth than what volunteers in the community could do.
Lee Daniels, follow-up further?
That's all for now. Thank
you. Thank you so much. Yeah, and I mean, it's I know that PPL and so many organizations rely on not only direct volunteer work, people working at very low pay often, even if they are being paid. I mean, just people are, and yet this is an expression of our community coming together as well. I know that Representative Katisa Witun had something, and I'll ask you to keep it really quick.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's really, really important for us to consider that the state can't do everything. The state doesn't do everything. And we don't want the state to do everything. These partnerships, the program, the local programs that Representative Daniels are talking about, they're doing incredible work on the ground. But I think, you know, oftentimes programs like that in local communities across the state do qualify for some of these grants. I mean, they need support to reach as many people as possible. And so I think that programs like this help make sure that we're not leaving anybody behind. So thank you, Representative Ryer. Thank you to PPL and Beacon. My parish is a member, so I appreciate the work that you do in particular. And
thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm regretting if I open things up. So Representative Hicks, I'm going to call on you very briefly if something very quick for Representative Hicks.
I promise I'll be very short.
Please.
So I'm from southeastern Minnesota as well, so I've gotten to work with many of the organizations in southeastern Minnesota doing some of the work. They are receiving funds. It's just which funds they're receiving. So Representative Daniels, in 2020, Ruth's House received 117,923 government grants from their 990. So, I mean, they're getting some support. And so I think it's important to understand that we have varied funding streams and that our nonprofits are doing their best to braid and blend, like Representative Keeler spoke of. And so I think we have to give them credit for that. But we also need to make sure that we're doing our work to enable them to do theirs.
Okay, so with that, this is also a bill that we will have another discussion about, assuming it's funded in our budget bill, and I certainly would hope that it would. It seems like such amazing work. So thank you so much to our two testifiers, to our bill author. With that, the chair lays over House File 910 for possible inclusion in a budget bill. Thank you so much to all of you again. And Representative Wolgamott, if you can make your way up and ask Vice Chair Keeler to move House File 862 to bring that before the committee.
So moved.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler. And sorry that it's a little bit tighter on time, especially given just how terrific ECFV is. I'm going to say that right up front and betray my biases here. So Representative Wolkamott, I don't think you have an amendment, and the bill's been moved. And so please just dive in and welcome to the committee. So glad to have you here, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Pinto. Thank you very much, Vice Chair Keeler. And thank you very much, committee members, for the opportunity to come before you this morning to present House File 862, which is a bill to appropriate $500,000 in fiscal year 2024 and $500,000 in fiscal year 2025 to fund two MDE staff positions that would support early childhood family education work throughout our state. Mr. Chair and members, the ECFE staff persons would provide operational support and guidance to programs, including but not limited to providing professional development and education support, assisting with marketing and outreach, and facilitating collaborations with public and private organizations who serve families. just to give you some context of the breadth of work that ECFB does, they've been in existence in Minnesota for over 45 years and are available in all 327 school districts and 87 counties. ECFB parent educators provide support and empowerment to parents and to families. There's a significant demand for parent educators throughout our state, and these two MDE positions will help support ECFB providers in their critical work. Parents, grandparents, caregivers from all over Minnesota benefit from these educational opportunities and will benefit by having two full-time employees who are focusing exclusively on supporting them, on making sure that the families get these resources and that they have the resources they need to do this critical work throughout all 87 counties of our state. With that, Mr. Chair and Madam Vice Chair, I have Sarah Kiever, who is a parent educator in the St. Cloud and Stock Rapids School District, to provide further testimony to this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Sarah McKeever, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony, and welcome to you.
Good morning, Chair Pinto and committee members. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott, for inviting me here today to speak on behalf of House File 862. My name is Sarah McKeever, and I'm a licensed parent educator of 15 years, currently working in early childhood family education, fondly known as ECFE, in the St. Cloud Area School District. I'm honored to have this opportunity to share with you how important this bill is for myself and my colleagues in early childhood. I know you value ECFE and the relationship-based work that has been done with families over 300 school districts in Minnesota for nearly five decades. Many of you have been in ECFE classes with your families. We cannot thank you enough for your support. After the last several years, parents with young children are beginning to feel safer, bringing their children into groups and inviting teachers into their homes. We've seen more young children with developmental delays due to the multiple stressors on families at this time. As a universal access program, early childhood family education is a key piece of the early childhood system, providing educational and social support for parents of young children from birth to kindergarten entry. One parent of a toddler who joined my class just last week, she shared a common sentiment. On one hand, she was glad someone had encouraged her to join ECFE, and she was excited for the opportunity for herself and her child. On the other hand, she wished she'd known about it earlier. We need to do better. Before 2003, there were two full-time, experienced individuals dedicated to supporting ECFE coordinators and staff across all the school districts in the state. Since the Department of Children, Families, and Learning was eliminated in 2003, state support for ECFE has been severely limited. For the past 20 years, our state leadership has consisted of only one small portion of a person's role at MDE. This is when teachers and administrators came together themselves as MNAFE, the Minnesota Association for Family and Early Education. Some of my colleagues are here today. And we volunteer our time and our dollars to fill some of the gaps that were left by these two positions. So we're coming to you today to request funding to cover the cost of restoring these two state leaders and give them the funds that they will need to provide training to teachers and program directors across the state, initiate statewide marketing and outreach to families, communicate regularly with district leaders, and hear their needs, to build collaborations with state agencies, and to do overall strategic work that will position ECFE to serve families well for another 50 years. We can give all families the support that they want to be the best parents they can be, so their children get the great start they deserve. Thanks for the opportunity to be part of the discussion, and I invite any questions that you may have.
Thank you so much, Sarah McKeever. As we transition into questions, actually, first let me ask whether any members of the public wish to testify on the bill. We've had Sarah McKeever. Okay, good. We'll make sure to do that. I was going to ask Ms. Mock in House Research just to remind me and then help with others as well about, because this advanced previously through the House, I believe, this proposal. Can you just give the history?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So last year, a similar bill was introduced, but it was funded differently. It was funded when it was introduced by having 2% of each district's early childhood family education aid go toward these positions, these support positions. That was introduced, it was heard in this committee, early childhood last year. It was re-referred to Ed Finance, and it was included in the Ed Finance Omnibus Bill last year. Except when it was included in the Ed Finance Omnibus Bill, the 2% was changed to just a straight appropriation of $325,000 each year.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Mock. And I'll maybe note, this has been a big priority as I've spoken with folks in the ECFE community. Sarah McKeever's described that. I think when they first introduced it, it was going to reallocate existing funds. One of the criticisms that came, I should note somewhat from my colleagues on the GOP side, was to say, hey, wait a second, you're taking away money from ECFE. That's not right. So instead, we're saying, okay, fine, let's put new dollars to it, because good point. Let's not reallocate dollars, and that's what this does. So so thanks for your work to both of you. And then just one other thing I was going to highlight is I note that it's $500,000 a year. Maybe fiscal staff can remind me, Ms. Beckel, that then means it'd be that money goes into the base when you've got the same amount in both years in the biennium, Ms. Beckel?
Mr. Chair, Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. Yes, when there is a dollar amount in the final year of the biennium, in this case fiscal year 2025, and there's no other language saying that saying that it is one time, then that is assumed to be ongoing.
Okay, good. Yes. Thank you. And partly I'm asking these questions, members, because we together will be putting a budget together in March, and we're trying to sort of build up towards that. So I'm kind of asking questions to remind myself and everybody else up to speed, too. So Representative Katiza-Watoon, we'll kick off with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Wolgamott, for bringing this bill back again. I'm a current ECFE parent and a Little Eagles parent council member in Eden Prairie. And so this is something that's very near and dear to my heart. In fact, I had to switch from my regular Tuesday morning classes that run from 9 to 10:30 so I could be here with the committee. And now I'm on Wednesday. So I'm glad that I'm still able to attend. The support that I've received from the parents and the co-educators and just the entire program has been incredible as in my journey to parenthood. And I think that providing support at the MDE level for statewide growth of this program is critical, just to make sure that every family knows that this is available to them in their area. It's not something that's available across the United States, and so it's one of the things that makes Minnesota really unique, I think. And I'm curious if maybe Ms. Beckel could detail for us, at least in my district, ECFE programming is paid for on a sliding scale. So, families who make less money annually, they pay less for the services. We do run a couple of fee-free programming for low-income communities, neighborhoods in the area, which is, I think, really important as well. But so this funding for staffing and marketing and program operations, I think, would drive folks into the program, so then the districts are able to grow. And I just wanted to confirm that was the case.
We'll try Ms. Beckel or Ms. Mock, perhaps. Let's see. Bit of a jump ball. And we may need, and if you need the question repeated, if that's the problem, we can certainly do that. Ms. Beckel. Right.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so was the question how ECFE services were funded?
Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, and I guess I'm not sure if it's the same in every district across the state, so that might just be the confusion, but in my district, ECFE services are paid on a sliding scale, so families are contributing. It's not, this money is going to staffing the program, advertising the program, et cetera, statewide, but it's not, families are still going to opt in and pay for these services at the district level, correct?
Yeah, Ms. Beckel, or maybe Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so districts are allowed to adopt the sliding fee scale for ECFE services and programs.
And I think, Representative Katiza-Watoon, this simply adds staff at MDE to sort of help with the program overall, but the individual district programs will still be in place. And I see the bill author nodding his head about that.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Katiza-Watoon. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Referring back to House research, did I hear correctly that a previous version of this bill asked for $325,000?
Good. Ms. Mock?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hudson, yes, that's correct. That was the amount in the Ed Finance bill that was included in the Ed Finance bill last year.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you.
I think I suspect I know where you're going. Let's give it a try, Representative Hudson.
And was that for two FTEs as this bill requests?
Ms. Ma.
Yes, that was also for two FTEs.
Representative Hudson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No
problem. My question for the author, can you explain the increase from $325,000 last year to $500,000 this year?
Representative Wilmot.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Hudson. We, in consultation with the Department of Education, in consultation with the people in my district who I've been working on to put this forward, and with those who are involved in ECFE programming throughout the state, we feel that this is an appropriate number to not only fund these two full-time employees, but to be able to give them some resources so that they can go out and do this work. We don't just want to fund people, give them an office and say, good luck. We want to make sure that they have the tools and the resources that they need to do all these things. Again, we're tasking them with providing operational support and guidance to programs, providing professional development, education support, assisting with marketing and outreach, facilitating collaborations with public and private organizations serving families. There's nothing magical about the number 500,000. You know, I would love to see it even higher, honestly, so that we can do more work. But again, that was just a thoughtful, striking a balance of being able to hire these employees and being able to give them a reasonable appropriation that they can work with to fulfill all these different things that we're going to be asking them to do with all 327 school districts throughout all 87 counties in our state.
And I may be able to, I'll go back to Representative Hudson. I may be able to add a little bit of context to Representative Hudson that that was in the context of an education finance bill as opposed to being something that was proposed, and things were moving pretty quickly at that point, which is not to say that we weren't thinking it through as thoroughly as we can, but I could imagine, given that, again, when the bill was heard in committee initially, it didn't have any appropriation. So as things were moving pretty quickly, I can imagine that the bill's author and the advocates, as they considered, said, hey, things moved pretty fast back then, but as we think about it further, we've got a better sense of what it really takes. But back to you, if you have follow-up, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. So the Division of Early Learning already has, as part of its mission, according to their website, a program implementation, information, funding, oversight to support educators and administrators in local school districts. I'm wondering how these two new positions interact with the existing functions at the Division of Early Learning. Are we just tacking on two people to the same mission, or is it a parallel operation? What's the interaction there?
And we may have staff from MDE who may be able to help with that as well, but Representative Volgamati, to you or to Ms. McKeever or otherwise.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. And I would like to defer to Ms. McKeever, but I will say that, right now, MDE is doing the best they can with what they've got, and they have, it's my understanding, they have someone there who, you know, has many things on their plate, and this is one of them, and they're doing the best they can, and that's great, and we appreciate that. But, again, we see that the need is here. We've worked on this bill in consultation with minority concerns that we've heard concerns from the minority caucus that we've heard in previous committees as far as how we're funding this. But again, this is about parental involvement. This is about empowering parents to be involved. And by having two full-time employees who are focused exclusively on ECFE, again, throughout 327 school districts, 87 counties, it's going to be able to add to the capacity, and it's going to be able to increase the amount of families that they are going to be able to support. But, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I know that Ms. McKeever will have more to say about
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I'll ask her to do so. Keep it pretty brief if she can. And I will note that regardless, I will certainly be asking, since this bill is being laid over, I want to have, if somebody's not here, to get a specific answer from the department to Representative Hudson's question. But let's see what Ms. McKeever has to say.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I would just like to mention that the initial bill with 2% of the ECFE allocation actually was roughly $500,000, which was our original ask from the opening of this bill. And also, we're asking for these positions to be parent educator trained so that they're intimately familiar with what it is that ECFE does. And that's really the uniqueness of these roles, because they really understand the potential and what is needed to really help ECFE thrive.
And I forgot about that, actually. Yeah, so it actually sort of came in at 500,000, got pushed. We do have an MDE representative here, I think, who can take a stab at answering Representative Hudson's question. So we'll have you swing on over. Okay, please identify yourself. Welcome. And then you can answer the question.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, Shana Morris, Assistant Director of Government Relations at MDE, and Representative Hudson, to your question, I think you heard already that a number of administrations ago, there was more support at the department for this work. Since those cuts happened, and you know, 20 years ago, we have one position that is shared between this work and our School Readiness Plus program. The support that that position is able to provide is sort of like, I would say, maybe a basic level, like how to implement, how to create a budget, how to orient new ECFE leaders to the field. I think what the stakeholders here are asking for is sort of like the next level, like recognizing there's a shortage in the field, recognizing there's a shortage of parent educators and licensed professionals to do this work, and trying to take that up, recognizing the current environment that we're in, and trying to overcome with the pandemic, right, and kind of all of the things that created. So that's how I think we're looking at this, in terms of we're providing this support. We're helping them to create their budgets, to do the implementation work, to triage, technical assistance, that type of a thing. And this would be kind of taking it up a notch.
Representative Hudson, follow up.
Yeah, just real quickly, it's my understanding that the ombudsperson for family child care is currently only funded at $125,000 per year. Is there a value basis for the disparity between that and the $250,000 per employee that we're asking for here? Is there a difference in the skill set, the job description, the workload, something that would explain why it costs $100,000 more to have an employee that works on ECFE projects as opposed to family child care?
And one reminder is this is a proposal sort of from the education side. So it may be that if we end up funding both in our budget, that'll be an especially good question to me, because you'll be comparing how we decide to do them. So for now, this is just a group saying it. But do you have any thoughts, Ms. McKeever or Representative Wolgamott, in response to that question?
I would just say that, yeah, that sounds like something else that would be great to fund. It's maybe a little bit outside of the scope of the bill that we're putting forward today. But, yeah, those are the kinds of things that I think as a state we should be really considering investing in.
And I could imagine there are some different reasons for that, but I guess, again, we can, as we put together a budget proposal and we see where the numbers line up, we can look at that at that point. But it's a good comparison. Well, I've got several folks, so Representative Katizer-Tune, I have multiple people on the list here, so I'm going to ask folks to keep it really sort of to the 60-second version. Representative Hicks, you're the first up.
Thank you so much, Chair. And I this is just a comment as someone who's a proud MAPE member for my MAPE siblings, who are asked all the time by this body to do things without full funding to do them. State employees work really, really hard to do everything that we are asked to do in statute, but simply funding our salaries without funding us the resources to go out and do true community engagement and have those conversations and develop marketing tools and develop materials and provide TA isn't fair, and it creates a situation for many of my MAPE siblings where we are stuck. We've been asked to do something, we've been told we have to do it, but we have no resources to create it, to do it, and to implement it. And so to the author's credit, wanting to do more than just funding a salary and putting someone at a desk is incredibly important. And I just wanna say from the bottom of my heart, thank you for considering that there are other costs more than just salary. There is development of outreach. There's development, I would assume, in this position, of toolkits for districts to be able to do the things that we're asking them to do. And all of that development comes from the amazing employees that are developing it. But actually turning those thoughts and ideas into tangible items that we can provide to our districts costs money. And so I appreciate that that has been a priority for this bill, and I am so excited to move this forward.
Thank you so much, Representative Hicks. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really want to hop on the train and tout the benefits of ECFE. My wife is also on the Bloomington Early Learning Services Advisory Council, and our family, and I've even been able to attend classes on occasion as well. And I know that this is on their ask as well. And I really wanted to emphasize a point that both Representative Wolgamott and Ms. McKeever made, which is that ECFE empowers parents as well. To borrow a phrase from, I believe, a former member of a previous iteration of this committee, ECFE saved my kids from me. And I think that's a really, really critical piece here, that this is one of those programs that really serves kind of everybody in a family and does so incredibly well. I knew how important ECFE was before I became a parent, but the breadth and depth of the services that ECFE provides is just, it's nothing short of incredible. So thank you. I do hope this is something that can move forward in our budget, and really excited to see this move forward.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. We've got several more members, including my new protocol of always calling on Lee Daniels. So Representative Lee, real short if you can.
Yes, very quick. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Wolgamott and Ms. McKeever for bringing this proposal before us as a ECFC alum. I also want to provide some context for other members who may not have been following this, but this position was cut 20 years ago by an administration that strategically underfunded our public education system. And so this amount is not even enough, and we're just trying to make ourselves whole 20 years later because we, you know, have the ability to do so. So definitely is a part of funding MDE more with ombudsman positions and you know, further places, right? Because we should be adding more FTEs, right, to this department that has lost a lot of institutional knowledge in the last 20 years when this administration decided to just strategically underfund our public education system. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm going to skip over Representative Katizo Atun, and I appreciate you being willing to do that. Representative Zeleznikar, and then we'll go to Lee Daniels and the author and get out of here.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. This will be quick. I visited ECFE in my district on Friday, so I'm a big fan of what ECFE is and understand its importance. My question is just on this percentage of this additional funding. What the percentage will be for salary for the teachers versus marketing, toolkits, and program implementation. If I could see that as we move forward, that would be great. Thank you.
Representative Zeleznikar, that's a great point. And so if there's more that the department can provide in response to Representative Hudson's question, and then certainly be helpful to all of us, if the ECFE advocates and the bill author could help give a sense as to how that $500,000 would be spent. and not at the moment, but just over the next month or so, if you could get that to us, that'd be very, very helpful. Thank you. Great question. Lee Daniels, and then the bill author.
Thank you, Chair. My colleagues have covered the information that I was going to talk about, so I'll just say just a brief. I just think this is adding two more FTEs at $250,000 each, no matter where the salary ends up, when they already have 450 FTEs, and I know a lot of people that work for the state, and I know some of them work really hard, and I know some of them don't. I'm just frustrated that this session is going so fast, and every bill we see has millions and millions and hundreds of millions of dollars going to each bill, and I'm just wondering, if all these programs are actually going to do what they're supposed to do, and that's, it's overwhelming the amount of money that's projected to be spent. And since we have a $17.6 billion surplus, I have not seen a bill come in yet that would actually give some of that money back to the taxpayers, other than the governor's proposal to cut check, which I don't agree with that. But I caution the committee and the DFL to slow the pace, make sure we get this right. We've been through, I don't know how many sessions now, and I don't know, probably a couple hundred, maybe 250 amendments, and not a single amendment has been accepted. So, you know, we were supposed to be working together, and this is not working together. It's just my comment.
Representative, I guess, Lee Daniels, I'm a little bit confused just because under both Republicans and Democrats, we hear bills that get considered for inclusion in budgets. I'm thinking about the committees I was on when I was in the minority, and in January, we heard a whole bunch of bills to spend money to do various things, and they get laid over. So we're not making a decision about this right now. as was true for really either of the bills. The first bill we sent to another committee, and I suspect their committee will also lay it over. So in this, this is, to my mind, exactly the same as it's been all the way through. I mean, of course, this is not the tax committee, so we wouldn't be considering other proposals. But I understand what you're saying, and as bills come back up, we do put together a budget, we'll be here to have these conversations. Representative Wolkenbott, bill author, final words from you, sir.
Well, thank you again, Chair Pinto and Vice Chair Keeler and committee members, for taking the time to consider House File 862. I really respect Lee Daniels' concern about making sure that we're taking these dollars that we have as a state and putting them back into our taxpayers. And, Mr. Chair, I want to be clear. Parents are taxpayers. Grandparents are taxpayers. Caregivers are taxpayers. This bill is going to empower these taxpayers so that they can be in a position to support our children, who are also future taxpayers. Let's Do Right by ECFE, this program that has been, by statute, has existed for over 45 years, and again, is available in all 327 school districts in 87 counties. Let's Do Right by our children, and please, I urge your consideration for House File 862 in your finance omnibus bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Vice Chair, and thank you, committee members.
Thank you, Representative Wolkenbott. With that, the chair lays over House File 862 for consideration, for continued conversation as part of our budget. But this is terrific. And Sarah McKeever, thank you so much to you and to the many ECF advocates who've worked on this. Members, I need 30 more seconds of your time just to set us up for Thursday. We're going to be hearing House File 2, which is the paid family leave bill. That bill is in our committee's jurisdiction for two reasons. Article 2 of the bill that relates to MFIP, and then also the impact of the bill on children and families. That bill has many committee stops talking about insurance and various issues, very important issues, but I'll be pretty strict in our committee about keeping us to the issues that it has jurisdiction in our committee. And so we'll have a particular amount of time for that and really focus on those areas. In addition, we'll be hearing a funding bill from Representative Katiza Witun that will, again, the plan is to lay it over. And then also we'll be receiving a presentation on, you have this in your materials, and I would ask you to either put it in your save folder, this is the Minnesota Kids Count book, or I'd ask the pages, and Ms. Kahn can help with this, to make sure that they get held on to, because I don't want to have to have another whole set of these on Thursday. So with that, I will look forward to seeing you all then, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.